Hey, welcome to The Look Back, my pandemic podcast, or hopefully post-pandemic podcast, broadcasting here from the basement of Newman Media Studios. My name is Keith Newman, and I'm the host of The Look Back. And this is a place where we have some fun conversations with old friends, a few newsmakers, and some rule breakers, all in the name of sharing insights and experiences along with a little bit of levity and fun. I hope you enjoy the conversation, and if you're so inclined, or perhaps even open to some bribery, you'll share this podcast with some friends who might also enjoy it. Let's go on to the show. Hey, David Strom, welcome to The Look Back.
Hey, how are you doing? It's nice to see you and chat with you. It's been a million years.
And that's what gives me such a joy in doing this podcast, reconnecting with people, and we use as an excuse all these social threads that we see your updates, whether it's your work or your personal, and I get a little bit of an update, but good to see you in person. David, how are you?
I'm good. I'm very healthy, happy, productive. What more could you ask for?
Well, there's probably a few other things, but we won't go there on this podcast.
Okay, right. Yeah, right.
Hey, listen, it's also fun to talk to somebody in St. Louis versus somebody, you're still in St. Louis, right?
Still in St. Louis, yes.
Instead of these great flyover cities that I don't get to land into often enough, I'm stuck with L.A. and Boston, New York. You know the drill. What's the view from St. Louis these days in terms of the world, the place we live in today?
Well, I came here kind of reluctantly because my wife is from here many years ago. And I said, all right, let's give it a shot. Let's try it out. I've never lived in the Midwest. I've lived on both sides of the country, right, as you well know. And I love it here. Been here now 15, 16 years. It's just fantastic. People are genuinely friendly. You know, in LA, people are superficially friendly. You know, generally you don't meet your neighbors unless there's an earthquake at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Well, I should do a little backstory here, David, because, of course, we were alumni partners, brothers at CMP back in the day. We also spent some overlapping times at Ziff Davis, and I'm sure a bunch of others, because your journalism career, which continues to this day, you've covered everything. You've done everything. I remember network computing, but there were so many other fantastic. What were some of your high points?
Well, network computing, I was the founding editor in 1990 and basically launched that publication and, you know, was immediately in revenue the first year, had a great staff. A lot of the people that I hired still have something to do with the magazine. People went on to, you know, do some pretty fantastic careers, either as analysts or as, in tech journalists. So I'm very proud of that accomplishment. I've written for a number of B2B sites. You know, a lot of them are no longer in existence or hobbling along. I've written for most of the IDG sites. Ziff Davis, I've written, you know, started my career in tech journalism with PC Week, now eWeek. So that was, you know, fun times when money flowed like water and, you know, we could call up IBM and say, hey, what's this new OS2 thing? We want to fly a bunch of people down to Austin, Texas and get a briefing. And, you know, 3 days later, we were sitting in an auditorium with about 5,000 IBMers that were working on the project. You know, yeah, those were very heady days.
So many good and bad things about where we were when we were there, but I always look at it as those were the best of times. I mean, we can kind of see where the challenges were. Like we didn't have Google.
We didn't have Google. We didn't have chatbots. We had to talk to people on the phone.
It was funny. I mean, and look, networking and security has been the two evergreen themes, topics, what issues for the last 30 years. So you picked an amazing category where I went into retail and consumer tech and doing some of that stuff with CRN and CRW and on the Mac side of things. I mean, you've just been in an evergreen area that just, it seems like it's amazing.
Well, I was, you know, working in corporate America, and we put in the first local area networks in the mid 80s. You know, so PCs came in the early 80s And we got bought by the truckload of this insurance company, which, you know, before just had mainframe terminal.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we basically liberated all these end users who, you know, they couldn't program in COBOL. You know, there wasn't a computing device for them. And so when PCs came out and you could write your own documents and calculate your own spreadsheets and build databases, I mean, that was just very heady times. And it was just mind blowing.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite story from the ever present year of the network, or the LAN days of Novell and Cisco and ARPNET and all that fun stuff?
So when I was at PC Week, I think it was 1988 or 87, we decided we were gonna do some tricks, you know, some sort of publicity things that, you know, to try to bring some attention. So we had a shootout between Ethernet, ARPNET, and Token Ring. And we put together this local area network of about, I don't know, 30 or 40 computers.
And where was this? Where did you do this?
This was done at one of the student labs at UCLA. We picked a spring break when there weren't any students there. And we brought in specialists from all over the country to help us. And Ethernet won, hands down, to the delight of Bob Metcalf and people like that. And it turned out that the reason why it worked so well was because the guys that, and we were running this on a network, Novell network, the guys who were developed the Ethernet drivers for Novell were running on the Ethernet cards themselves. And so the people that were there from Novell immediately called the managers of that team up and said, rip out those Ethernet cards and put in Token Ring, because we've got to get better performing drivers. And the only way to do that was to have the engineers use the damn thing. And so that benefited a lot of people. Of course, nobody knows about Token Ring now. Nobody's, you know, aren't even using wired networks. They're using Wi-Fi, which I guess is Ethernet of a different kind.
Right. And then with the age of the internet, you were very active with that whole birth, and from, you know, we said DARPA or Netscape or pick your flavor.
Well, you mentioned CMP, which is now a company, I guess it's called Informa. I think that's who runs that set of properties, more or less. So I went to the head of CMP. This is in 1990 when we were starting network computing. And I asked the president, Mike Leeds, I said, we need to buy the domain name cmp.com. And he looked at me and he said, what the hell are you talking about?
David, you wacko, what is this? You want me to spend $30 on what?
Well, actually, at that time, you could get it for free. You just had to request it. I mean, it was really kind of a bizarre time. I mean, nobody could anticipate to hear, you know, this was the demise of all these print pubs and print advertising. So right. We've been through quite a few changes.
There is a funny thing in terms of the look back, right, where we say, oh, digital transformation. Well, imagine if we only did X, Y, and Z back in those days to prepare us for, you know, the flood of activity that was going to come from that transition, right, that transformation from in media alone, much less technology.
Right, exactly. So here we are. We're still being transformed.
Yeah, we are.
Every day.
And let's and let's go ahead and go there. When you look at AI today, David, I mean, everyone goes, fear, opportunity, which side are you on? And of course, the answer is really neither. You have to take advantage of what you can take advantage of from a business efficiency, operations, productivity standpoint. And then you also got to protect yourself from everything that AI pretends. So where do you stand on you know, legislating some of this versus, you know, standard committees and things like that?
Well, I think, you know, I'm not going to look to any quick action by any of our wonderful lawmakers. You know, look how long it took them to put in, you know, all the various cybersecurity rules, you know, years, decades.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to happen anytime soon. So we've got to have industry self-regulate, which is definitely like putting a loaded gun in the hands of a child. You know, it's going to be tough. I think what's really different is the power of the tools to do things is both incredibly beneficial and incredibly potentially destructive. You know, it's not just, you know, it's like in the past when we've had innovations in technology, they had both good and bad elements to it. But I think the ante is up quite substantial. You know, chatbots can be used to identify threats very decisively, neutralize them all without any human, you know, intervention. But they, you know, also can spin up these fictional narratives and create code that has all sorts of malware in it, intentionally or unintentionally. I think that's, you know, so again, I think the benefits and the cost is going to be difficult. Where do I stand on the Skynet versus cure cancer metric? You know, I'm somewhere in the middle.
Oh, this is just a fun, ripe topic, though, to keep debating. So let's bat it around just another second. So if I'm reading an article, shouldn't I get to know if it's supported by ChatGPT or some other flavor?
Yeah, I think it's disingenuous for a lot of the tech sites that are creating ChatGPT or originated text. They have to label it as such.
Yeah, that's a simple journalistic rule that should be enforced. And by the way, there's probably something for academia in there as well. If you use, you know, the equivalent of a footnote or a, you know, whatever else, I'm forgetting the words, but
byline.
Yeah, byline, a footnote, something. Call it out that you're plagiarizing or using some other artificial additive.
But the thing is, in our industry, you know, all the data in the, that's used to train these models is ancient. You know, it's two years plus old. Right. So you're not going to be using it to generate tech news for quite some time, because it takes a lot of money and effort to train the models and bring it up to, you know, any kind of current state. So I think it's great that our industry is changing so rapidly, and it's too rapidly for the chatbots to be able to author meaningful analysis.
I do love some of the outcomes, though, that I've been able to create using these tools. So I don't want to just be like a naysayer of it. I think there's tremendous value.
No, I think businesses have to get smarter about what they can and can't do. They have to figure out ways that they can incorporate them into their services and products. I'm not saying just stick your head in the sand.
Yeah, I'm working with a company doing some customer support technology, and they're implementing Gen AI, and it just helps them access information much more rapidly and providing the customer support the proper answers, the right context in real time.
Right, but I don't want to be talking to a robot. You know, I don't want to go through a phone tree. You know, press one if you have problems with this. I want to talk to a human being. It's fine for those human beings to access all kinds of knowledge bases. Right. That's cool.
And feed that to the agent, right? Make them more productive. Because, you know, that churn on the customer support team side is huge, because they're frustrated. They can't get answers, all those things.
Right.
Yeah, cool. So, hey, another funny topic for you, and this came up in a chat I was having the other day, passwords. Have we outlived the notion of passwords? When will these flipping things die? Because I'm the worst. Like, I've tried everything. Hence, I have everything, and I just don't know where it is anymore. This password code and this last pass and this one key. And oh my gosh, I'm horrible.
So I think passwords are going to be the bane of our existence for quite some time.
Oh no.
I think if you can use a password manager, there's that steep hill that you have to climb where you got to get all your stuff encoded in the password manager and change them from, you know, your pet's name to something more complex. Yes. You know, and you know, who knew that so many people had pets 1, 2, 3, 4, 5?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Exactly. But no, the problem is, you know, so the problem is twofold. First, we're lazy and we reuse them. And second, yeah, I mean, everybody has to opt, you know, cop to that. You know, it's just unfortunate. But also, it's so complicated to implement. You know, even the best password managers that automatically look at what you're doing online and say, hey, you seem to be entering a username and password. Can I help you strengthen that. You know, there is still a lot of work to do. I have been using Zoho Vault, which is a little known product. It's free. It works really well.
Okay.
And I want to, Proton, the people that have the, you know, secure email, and they have a VPN product that came out recently with a password manager. And I went through hell to try to get my collection of passwords uploaded into Proton. I eventually just said, screw it, I'm going back to Vault. But I have them all in there. I've got like 500 entries in this thing. You know, it's, I mean, I'm probably the ridiculous use case, but still it's a pain in the neck. There's no question.
Is there a scenario where you see it going away, identity management tools, some other security workarounds?
No. Here's the problem.
Yeah, so, tell me what I was going to ask you, the three biggest problems with identity also.
Well, so the problem with identity is it is an ultra specialized field. So yeah. Let's take your average company with 1,000 people. How many people do you think really understand identity management in that company? Right. One, maybe two. I mean, I'm not joking. It's amazing.
Right.
The level of knowledge to pull it off and to make sure that you create this automated system that's going to work is phenomenal. And so those people get paid handsomely well, and they move about in very rarefied circles. And so until you can make identity work for the masses, you're always going to be stuck with this ultra specialization.
Yeah.
So that's part of the problem. The second thing is that you're always going to have security breaches because we're human. You know, we're busy, we're on our phones, we're not paying attention. Somebody sends us a phishing email, we open it and game over. You know, and there's going to be people who do that every single day. And hopefully they won't do too much damage to their own, collection of information or the business's collection. But that's the way that these attackers count on. It's just the fact that we're not paying attention.
Right. Any thoughts on ForgeRock and Authy? Are there some solutions there?
Yeah, Okta, Ping, ForgeRock. I mean, there's a number of companies that are at the head of the class with identity. Okay. They've been around for a long time.
Yep.
You know, they've got some pretty solid products.
Okay. What other hot topics have you been studying, evaluating, throwing rocks at?
Oh, gee, where to start?
Yeah.
Well, part of the problem is in security, there's, you know, 100 companies that are established every week that are trying to do something. It's hard to stay in. I mean, it's good for me because I never lack for anything to write about. But a lot of these companies come out too early. Their product isn't very well tested. They don't. Almost everything nowadays is an edge case. You know, it was a set of circumstances that really happens rarely. Mm-hmm. And the attackers look for those intersections and try to leverage their way into companies.
Right. So does anything that fits your criteria as either dangerous, compelling, life-changing, or are we still talking sort of iterative steps in the world of security and the product, you know, roadmap there?
Well, I think it's, you know, we all tend to get, we all tend to sort of lose sight of being the best at keeping our security profiles as good as they can be. Like, how many people run Facebook Messenger on their phones? I mean, that's just a disaster for security. You know, if you want your privacy broadcast to 1,000 different advertising people at once, run that on your phone.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah. I mean, but what do you do, you know? So then you have to not communicate with people on Facebook because there is a web client that you can use, but it's not as functional. And Facebook does that deliberately because they want you to run their software.
Right. Well, that is interesting in the worlds of social media. So Are we finding ourselves at an ever-increasing risk, or are we feeling like we're getting a little better around the protection? And I'm speaking mostly on the consumer side, not the enterprise side. But
well, it's kind of like COVID, right?
Yeah.
We've all forgotten about that. You know, oh, the pandemic's over. Nobody's dying from it. People are still getting sick.
Yeah.
They may not even know they're sick, you know, because it's so mild.
And they may be.
So we just kind of move our attention onto something else. And I think that's the problem with a lot of the problems with IT or information security is that, you know, we're not paying attention.
Yeah.
So the risk is still there.
Yeah. So it's rather than getting you to do the next shootout in networking and security software and everything else, what's going to be the next big theme that helps, you know, usher in that next era, is besides AI, I guess, because that's obviously a super ingredient.
Yeah, I think AI is an interesting topic. I think the bigger trend is how much can you automate with security so that you don't need operator intervention. I mean, I can run a tool which scans my network every 10 minutes and comes up with exceptions. And those exceptions could be meaningful. They could be just somebody pulled the plug on their computer by mistake. You know, there could be any number of reasons. And so I want an automated tool that says, here are the three things that look like, you know, really, you know, red alert, big issue.
And that escalates to a human, or does that escalate to another automation layer?
It depends on what you want to have done. And at some point, do you want to have a human do the mitigation?
Yeah.
Do you want to make sure that that's what you want have happened before you let the machines take over and we move into the Skynet era? You know, I don't know.
David, what about our world of journalism where we started? What do you see happening with the whole process of people going out, meeting with companies, researching stories, backgrounds, technology, references, use cases, and all of that stuff? There seems like there's this slow shift from good journalism to pay to play and stuff that gets worked out. How do you view that whole industry and background that you were part of?
So when we started out in the 80s and the 90s, the average computer business publication had dozens of journalists working for them, right? I mean, they were big staffs.
Yes.
You know, we had copy editors.
PC Week might have had 1,500 people. I don't know.
Well, they had about a staff of 60 editors back in the day. Now they have one or two people. I mean, it's just, you know, the internet basically disemboweled the operating models for these publications. And so there are fewer people that are working there. They're paid less. Freelancers are paid next to nothing. So I think the shift has happened. I don't think it's in the process of happening, as you imply. I think it's already done. I think the quality of journalism for consumers and businesses is abysmal. And people don't necessarily know what they're talking about. You're hiring people from offshore that you know, work for a lot less money. And the vendors can say what they want to say with impunity.
Yeah, and you know, so you and I could go down the journalism side, but in our world where we were helping companies make decisions on products and relationships and partnerships and all that good stuff, what does that mean today if that quote objective source is now subjective?
Well, we've seen it in the mainstream media. You know, it's people want to get outraged when they read the general press.
Yeah.
You know, they don't care about actually learning the facts. And I think to some extent that's true in the consumer tech space. You know, there are some places like Wirecutter, you know, and those guys that actually are testing stuff out in person.
Yeah.
But that's really the exception rather than the norm.
No, clearly there's very few. What about places like the royal research firms that have been anointed the heads of decision making when it comes to recommending technology and product and so on. Maybe one starts with the letter G. I don't know. Maybe one, I don't, you know.
Yeah. I'll name it if you want. I don't care.
Maybe two start with the letter G. But are these to be trusted today? And if so, you know, it's very limiting in terms of who they will talk to based on, you know, the size of company and that relationship also. So I know my question might seem a little biased in its delivery too, but do you have a thought in terms of those sources as being objective or helpful?
Well, they've been in the pay-to-play space for years.
True, true.
You know, they don't write about anybody unless they get a big hefty check from someone. So right. I don't necessarily trust their analysis. I use it as a beginning point for my research. You know, if those guys mention the space that I'm in and they have, you know, a list of their magic quadrant or top favorite vendors, I start with that and see if I agree with it or not. But I've been around long enough where I have my own opinion. So, you know, I don't necessarily take them as the gospel truth. And I think that IT managers are in a similar state. You know, the ones that have been around a while, they use that to seed their initial investigations, but I don't think they use that as the operating Bible.
Mm. So putting your hat on as you're an IT manager of a Fortune 5000 size company, not to relegate it to a certain, you know, segment or anything, but how do you make decisions on buying? You have to set up all the test facilities yourself, which is, you know, quite an investment. Is that being done across the board, or is there?
Well, this is where it helps to have the cloud, because I can set up a test environment of 40 computers in about 3 seconds, you know, and I don't have to worry about the current version of Windows that's running on them and that has been patched. I just bring up that instance.
Here's what I'm asking, Dave. Is it time for network computing 5.0?
Well, we had, you know, when we set up network computing, we built our own labs. I mean, it was
yes.
It was a big capital investment. In fact, we went to IBM. We said, "Can we get a mainframe?"
We looked at us like we were nuts. We were doing the labs out of the ZD playbook with Mac user. Nobody else was doing it. We would ask Apple for help, and they wouldn't even answer the phone.
Right. Right. Yeah, those were fun times.
Okay. So
the cloud, I think, has really helped companies because they can test things out with very low capital cost, and you know, have a reasonable, you know, they should have a production environment that they've replicated for testing purposes.
Okay. What about the business opportunity for something more transformative than what's available today to do robust objective testing, as well as some robust, aggressive, journalistic-based reporting in this world that is the number one economy driver, which is technology?
I don't think there are very many robust B2B tech sites left. You know, the one I work for, SiliconANGLE, one of the reasons why I'm there right now is because I think they do a good job of that.
No, I'm a big fan of theirs as well. I think they do a very good job. So, David, this has been great. Any other thoughts, parting shots?
Well, it's been, I feel very privileged to have spent my whole career seeing the rise and now the slow fall of the tech industry. You know, I was there at the very early stages, and I was very lucky that it coincided with my own interests and was able to ride that, you know, ride that rocket ship. And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, you did a great job. You were a phenomenal resource. Whenever I would call and ask for your help, educating me in all these different areas, it's been great chatting with you. Great catching up.
Same here. Take care now.
Bye, David. Thanks for listening to The Look Back. We do appreciate your support, welcome any feedback, and would love it if you would subscribe to this podcast and even consider sharing it with some of your friends. For more information and other cool info, check us out at newmanmediastudios.com.